Blog Talk Radio.
Mama Africa, Mama Africa, am I coming home? Hello, Mama Africa, how are you? I'm feeling fine, and I hope you're fine too. Hello, Mama Africa, how are you? I hope when you hear these words, your gray turn blue, gray turn blue. I'm saying these words to let you know how much I care, and I won't let go, even oceans away, you're with me day by day. Memories of you keep flashing through my mind. The very thought of you makes my time. Hello, Mama Africa, how are you? I'm feeling fine, and I hope
another edition of Your World News. I'm your host, Solomon, and joined with me right now is Peter Fowler, who is once again joining us live and direct from Glendale, Arizona, the now infamous state of Arizona, which is his only endemic of the institutional racism and the continued attacks on black and brown-skinned people in this country. So even though Arizona seems to be getting all the publicity, it's a common thread throughout the empire known as the USA. So without further ado, I'd like to have Peter introduce himself. And Peter, if you can introduce yourself and kind of give the listeners a little taste of what they can expect on this show today.
Alman, good to be with you again. Peter Fowler, and like you mentioned, from Billy the Beast here in the not-so-great state of Arizona, which is right now kind of the front lines of the war on racism and xenophobia that is rearing its ugly head again in this country. And hopefully if our guest is able to join us today, we'll get another firsthand taste of what's going on an individual and personal level. And even if not, some of the things that are going on here in Arizona are indicative of the rising tide of racism that we're seeing in this United States. So I'm sure we'll be able to get our teeth into a number of issues along those lines today.
Yeah, and I just wanted to give an FYI to everyone that's tuning in. The theme of the show today was fighting police terror, and we were supposed to have a guest on today, very courageous woman who is going through utter hell right now in the municipality where she's living, and she's been experiencing nothing short of police terror and harassment. However, she's unable to come on the show today due to extenuating circumstances that just came up at the very, very, very last minute. But she will be coming on the show probably, I would say, within the next 2 to 3 weeks for sure. And that's going to be an exclusive interview. You definitely want to tune into that. So she'll be coming on and talking about how her case is going against the police force within the municipality where she lives, and the particulars around the case. It's something that you really, really want to tune in to listen to. It's unfortunately not novel in the U.S. There's you know, many people of color throughout the U.S. who are experiencing similar bouts against very repressive, institutionally racist and corrupt police system in this country. And Peter and I have had this discussion many times before in terms of basically just, you know, talking about that that in order for us to see any kind of tangible change in this country where you don't have 7-year-old girls like Ayanna Stanley Jones of Detroit, Michigan, you know, losing their lives, having their lives stolen from them, from the murder of, you know, the guns and the hands of murderous police. If we really want to see this ending, you know, the police force has to be radically revamped. It has to be deconstructed to be reconstructed. It's not something where you can have a few good cops, and there are some good police officers out there, but the system itself is so corrupt. You can't have individual cops here and there and have the system just change. You know, even some of the more humanitarian or you know, dare I say, progressive cops out there, they'll be the ones that will tell you first that it's the problem is with the system. Its system has to be changed because it's a system that reinforces racist stereotypes, profiling, you name it. And with that profiling is not just like somebody, you know, following you through a store. Profiling, you know, leads to, yes, individuals being shot, being tased to death because they are not just profiled as, oh, these are potential, you know, criminals because they're black and brown skin, but they are, but in their warped reality, these are potential black and brown skinned men that are, the way I've been conditioned is that they're hyper sexual, they're hyper violent, and they could be packing anything. And so I'm not even going to take a chance. I'm going to take them out. And beyond that, their lives are worthless. So, you know, if I do take them out, you know, there's a very good chance that I'm going to get away with it. So, you know, when she comes on, we're going to be covering a range of those things. And we continue to invite you to call in. The telephone number is 347-945-5191. That's 347-945-5191. You're welcome to call in and join Peter and myself in this dialogue. And you know, I think a good place before we actually you know, get started, I think that a good place maybe to start off with it might be to you know, to start talking about this debacle, this corporate capitalist rooted, you know, debacle going on right now, where we're seeing masses of loss of life in the Gulf of Mexico, in terms of the oil catastrophe, you know, caused by BP, and pretty much has been underwritten by for corporate interest. So, Peter, I know you had some thoughts about this. We talked off air about this. So I'll let you start off, and then afterwards we'll get into some clips and some other things.
Yeah, you know, this is it's a crime of the largest magnitude that we're seeing unfolding in the Gulf of Mexico, and the perpetrators in this crime will go unpunished. And you know, because this is corporate crime, and these are corporate the criminals, the so-called white-collar criminals that we're seeing. And it's interesting when we're talking about the, you know, how, you know, we started at the top of the hour talking about police state measures and police terror and the racism at the hands of the police that is really born out of the law and order ideology that was birthed in the current regressive political movement born in the 1960s with the Goldwater conservatives. And you know, so that was you know, amped up as part of the regressive retrenchment towards, you know, regaining some political power, and the fuel for that movement was racism. Obviously, was a retrenchment against the strides gained by people of color in this country in the civil rights movement. Now, how is that connected to what's unfolding in the Gulf of Mexico? Well, it is connected because we're seeing how the law and order, the tough on crime, which means the further crackdown on people of color in this country, an explosion of the prison industrial complex, and how crime, when we talk about crime is what? It's a black-faced issue in the mind of in the popular minds of the American people. And we talk about crime, it's all about protecting our persons and our properties, you know, from that criminal. Well, what we're seeing in the Gulf of Mexico is corporate crime unfolding on to this point, unforeseen scale. The damage that's being done and that will be done over the course of decades as this debacle unfolds is uncalculable at this point. And it's because the nature of the capitalist system allows for these kinds of things to happen. You know, this isn't the first disaster of its kind, and it won't be the last disaster of its kind. You know, we've seen some disasters that are rooted in capitalism so far this year, the Massey mines, where several miners were killed because of the corporate system, allowed for the Massey Mining Company to get away with without using regulatory procedures, and the corporate climate that basically suggests that corporations police themselves, that corporations regulate themselves. You know, they basically ask them to do that. Hey, would you be kind enough to regulate yourself? Well, we know that's a bunch of crap. And so it's the same thing as happening with BP. It's well documented, the shortcuts that BP took in the time leading up to the blowout, which was totally preventable. And the reason it happened is because BP wanted to cut corners. There were cost-saving issues at hand, and they chose to go the route of cutting corners and saving costs. And the fact that there were no federal regulations that needed to be followed, we end up with this kind of debacle. And so the kind of crime that's being committed here by corporate entities, and the U.S. government is complicit in the commission of those crimes, far, far, far outweigh the relatively petty crimes that people are being locked down for in huge numbers, you know, like carrying marijuana. Minute amounts of marijuana people get arrested and locked down for. And if you look at the statistics in the jails and prisons across this country, a ridiculous amount of the offenders are nonviolent offenders who were guilty of carrying small amounts of marijuana. And so, you know, to compare and contrast those crimes that are being committed across this across the country, and to see the different kinds of responses that our government and our society takes towards the perpetrators of those various crimes, is very telling about the values and the ideals of the United States of America. And so what we're seeing is a calamity against nature and against mankind in the Gulf of Mexico simply for the sake of profit. We're seeing that the profit system is literally killing off, you know, we won't know any numbers, you know, we won't know the kinds of numbers that the wildlife is being killed off and will continue to be killed off for months and years to come because of this disaster. But it's all being allowed to be done for the sake of profit, for the sake of private profit, I might add. Now, if the profit guard from that were nationalized and were going to the people of this country, you know, we might be able to make an argument for taking some risks like that. But all the profit gained from endeavors like, you know, the petroleum and so forth, those go into private coffers, and they maintain a system where a very, very few super elite wealthy individuals continue to get more and more wealthy, and the rest of us continue to suffer. And that's and that's going to continue to happen as long as we don't recognize it for what it is, this monster that we call capitalism. So there's definitely a connection between, you know, the two crimes, the kinds of crime that we're talking about today, Solomon, you know, capitalism drives both of those. It drives on the one hand, it drives the law and order ideology that is fueled by racism in this country, and it also drives the kind of ecological calamities that we're seeing in its relentless drive for privatized profit.
Yeah, you're exactly right, because, you know, what pushes the whole the whole notion for, you know, for everyone from, you know, Congress people, senators, you know, presidents to even, you know, to say, you know, drill baby drill, that, you know, that
right.
we're gonna continue to drill and drill and drill. And yes, we know that oil is not a renewable natural resource, that there is a limited amount of oil, and we know that, you know, that the Exxon Valdez, you know, has become like the one that everyone, you know, the point of reference that everyone mentions. But there was an enormous oil spill off the coast of you know, Southern California, and off the coast of Santa Barbara in 1979, I believe, and it was catastrophic. And then there was another one after that that was also in the Gulf of Mexico that was in, I believe, in the early 80s. Al Jazeera just ran a special on that. We see how oil has become a curse for people throughout the world, and I'm so glad that you mentioned that, Peter, the capitalism that basically it's kind of like the evil entity, the evil spirit. Since Peter, you've been to seminary school and you're a man of the cloth, it's that evil entity that enters someone's body and takes them over, and where they do everything from justifying all different types of things. We've seen in the horror movie where the evil entity leads the individual that's possessed now to just go on this killing spree, and capitalism is something that's been woven into the hearts and minds of so many Americans that quite frankly, the reason that they live in either trailer parks or housing projects or tenements, you know, with no health insurance, has to do with you know, it's capitalism that keeps them in that position, you know, without having those things that should be afforded to all human beings. And so when we look at oil, we look at just, for instance, the Niger Delta, you know, where Shell and Chevron have caused a humongous loss of life in the Niger Delta, a humongous loss of life. Matter of fact, they were culpable just this past year, you know, in a lawsuit, you know, for the death of Ken Saro-Wiwa, who was an activist, a Nigerian activist, who was murdered, who was, you know, subsequently murdered. And so Shell, you know, they settled out of court because they didn't want to go in court, because they went into court and they were found responsible. That was going to be on record. And so they actually went ahead and paid out the families of these victims. And basically later on, I forget how many millions of dollars it was. It really wasn't. It was basically a drop in the bucket in terms of what they're worth, or, you know, and you know, it wasn't really anything that they were going to miss for any time long. And afterwards, they had the audacity to say that, you know, we us paying this out doesn't mean that we're, you know, necessarily accepting responsibility for the deaths of folks like Ken Saro-Wiwa. You know, we're just, you know, we find that this is just our, you know, like our obligation or something like that. And it's just bull crap, man. It's to the highest level. But it's capitalism that drives that. It drives that. And so you have these multinational corporations that go into developing nations and plunder and steal the resources that, for God's sakes, if the resources are going to benefit anybody, it should benefit the people that occupy those lands first and foremost. You know, we saw with the people in Peru just a year ago, the people in Peru, the indigenous people in Peru, protesting last year, and there were like there were over 30 something people that were killed in clashes with the police. But the indigenous people in Peru were protesting based on the fact that they did not want their government to sell the drilling rights and the excavation rights of parts of the Amazon where they occupy. They simply did not want it, and they fought valiantly and won on a small scale where, you know, those rights haven't been awarded yet, and so the battle still continues to go on. But we see this, Peter. It's a theme throughout the world. We saw it in Bolivia, you know, before Evo Morales took office there, where, you know, Bechtel, a San Francisco-based multinational corporation, went into Bolivia and basically worked with the IMF and World Bank and the then corrupt government of Bolivia to privatize water, to privatize even rainwater, and cause a major, you know, water revolution where people, you know, just, you know, took to the streets. And a young boy, I forget his last name, but his first name was Victor. He was 15 years of age. You know, he was caught in the crossfire and killed by a bullet by one of the police. But this is the stuff that's going on. This is, and so we always tell folks that when you see a protest, whether it was the WTO protests in Seattle, Washington, you know, many years ago, you know, that should let you know. The corporate media in America is always going to frame it as if these people that are protesting are in the wrong, that there's some kind of crazy radicals and they need to be suppressed and they need to be put down by the cops. When you see, you know, these kind of mass protests, you should always critically engage yourself to find out what the hell are they protesting about? What are they protesting about? But unfortunately, in the U.S., we don't really have a school system that promotes critical thinking. So, Peter, while we're on critical thinking, could you let the listeners know about, you know, this institute that you've created that's geared around critical thinking? What's it called, and what are the aims of your what are the aims of this critical thinking institute that you have?
be happy to, Solomon. The name of the organization is the Academy of Critical Thinking, or ACT, is our acronym. And you can find us at theactinc.org. And the Academy of Critical Thinking is a startup with my partner Reggie Turner and some other folks. So we got together and we said, you know, critical thinking is a dearth of critical thinking in this culture, and some of us have had the opportunity to go out and get some education, and what we see is very often. When for those of us that have had the opportunity to go out and get some higher education, we're exposed to critical thinking skills. We're exposed to critical ideas. And what we want to do with the Academy of Critical Thinking is an attempt to bring critical thinking, the concepts and the skills of critical thinking, to the streets, if you will. Critical thinking is not something that is the sole property of schools and colleges and universities, and you know, there's a lot of folks who don't have access to go to college and to get higher education. So the Academy of Critical Thinking wants to take those particular skills to folks who will never find themselves perhaps in a college classroom, and so that's what we're about. And we are we're going to try to kick off some efforts this summer by engaging in some online activities that are going to help to teach critical thinking. And then as we grow, we'll get into teaching some other courses and exposing folks to the other kinds of activities to get people involved in critical thinking. And that's so important because of the propaganda that we're deluged with day in and day out in this culture. Particularly when we talk about capitalism and the values and the ideologies that go along with capitalism, you know, the attitudes and the mores needed for smooth functioning of such a system, you know, as well as for people to thrive as members of a capitalist society, those kind of values and mores and ideals are things like greed, individualism, competitiveness, exploitation of others, materialism or consumerism, and you know, these ideas are inculcated into people by the schools themselves, by the media, and in our workplaces. And because of the society we live in today, because of the advanced capitalist society that we're in, and the control of all of those outlets, or all of those outlets to some degree at least, that capitalism plays, capitalism corporations control the major media outlets, you know, the major television outlets, and the movies that Hollywood puts out, the textbooks. I mean, we're seeing right now what a travesty of anti-intellectualism and ideology-driven agendas are being played out in the state of Texas as they revise their school books and their textbooks, and those kind of things are going to impact school children for years to come until we do something about it. Now, the Academy of Critical Thinking wants to try to teach folks to be able to think critically about the ideas, the values, the concepts, the thought processes that we are bombarded with. And first of all, you know, just recognizing that we're bombarded with ideas, values, all the time, because we live in such a media-driven culture. I mean, you know, the television statistics tell us that most households watch hours and hours and hours of television per week, and so the amount of advertising and marketing that people are being exposed to through the television and through media, other forms of media, is immeasurable, and so we want to teach folks how to think critically about what people are exposed to, the ideas they're exposed to, the narrative. The narrative is another thing that we need to think critically about, and there is a narrative that we all operate within. You know, the story of America. You know, I mean, we're about a month away from one of the focal points of the American narrative. You know, the Independence Day holiday, and actually we're in between too. You know, the Memorial Day holiday that we just took a look at in critical fashion, and then the 4th of July Independence Day holiday coming up. You know, if we talk about what those are, and we look at what our culture does with those holidays, they're emblematic of what the American narrative is. You know, and the American narrative is played out in a lot of other holidays too, the Thanksgiving holiday, Columbus Day holiday. And if we don't think critically about those holidays and the larger narrative, then we become puppets in a drama that's controlled by the ruling class. And so the Academy of Critical Thinking, we want to motivate as well as instruct folks how to think critically and to begin to think critically about those things. So the idea is that folks who engage with us at the Academy of Critical Thinking will be able to kind of dissect the news that comes to them, whether it's through a newspaper or through the television news. They'll be able to deconstruct things like the Memorial Day holiday, kind of the way we did on our last show. They'll be able to deconstruct other holidays and maybe start to ask questions about why we do what we do, which is so crucial. And it's important to be able to do those things to really get at the root of what's going on in our lives as a people. And you know, one example of that is what we just talked about, is what's going on with the oil blowout in the Gulf of Mexico, and what's really behind that, and what are the kind of politics that are making that happen, the law and order system in this country, you know, and how that's driven by racism and a conservative law and order agenda. So without critical thinking, people are more apt to just soak up the party line, if you will, or the narrative. So at the Academy of Critical Thinking, we want to try to engage folks at a variety of different intellectual and emotional levels to try to be able to think critically about the world around them to be better citizens. You know, in order to be better citizens, not just be better consumers and better materialists and better capitalists, but to try to think critically about our world around us in order that we can start to generate some positive social change. It's all about trying to create some kind of change that's going to make a better world for us. So that's what we're about at the Academy of Critical Thinking. And you can start to look for some online activities with the Academy of Critical Thinking next month, starting in the month of July.
Yeah,
and that's at theactinc.org.
Yeah, all right. Yeah, definitely. Folks, you definitely need to check that out and, you know, and try to even, you know, on your own level, make sure that you engage people in your community, not just even children. You know, there's so many adults need to heighten and continue to sharpen and hone their critical thinking skills, because we're continuously bombarded consciously and subconsciously with these value systems that are pretty much antithetical to our you know, the kind of existence that we talk about, that we want to live, but we've been so bombarded that we start to envelop and develop these amoral value systems that have been kind of just inculcated into us, and we start to act them out without even knowing it. And so it's you know, as Peter mentioned, it's important for us to know how to deconstruct these dominant narratives, and as the you know, Ed Bernays, who's known as the you know, the father, godfather of public relations and propaganda, you know, he said in 1923, propaganda is the executive arm of the invisible government. I mean, that's really deep. You think about it.
Yeah.
Propaganda is the executive arm of the invisible government, and I'm not a fan of Ed Bernays, the man. In any shape, form, or fashion, because I think he did a lot of, like, you know, unscrupulous things. But it's important to study these folks who developed, you know, these methods within these various systems that have been put in place to basically, you know, do everything from pacify us to get us to to be blind consumers. And Bernays was you know, Ed Bernays was the individual who came up with the whole program to when he was hired by Viceroy, you know, cigarette company to get women to start smoking more and more Viceroy cigarettes. And so he used you know models, you know, in these fur coats, you know during the Macy's Day Parade to walk around smoking these cigarettes, and knowing that most women would be sheep and they would see that and they would find that appealing, and then it wouldn't be so taboo for women to be smoking cigarettes in public. You know, he mastered the whole, you know, 4 out of 5 doctors say that, you know, eating, you know, bacon, you know, with your breakfast is the start of a healthy day. You know, knowing that most people aren't going to ask Peter, well, how many doctors did you interview? How many doctors did you actually poll? You know, people were just like, oh, wow, 4 out of 5 doctors, wow, you know. And, you know, he was on the Creel Commission, the whole support our troops, you know, slogan and all that stuff. It's really interesting stuff. If I could recommend one book for this show that people need to pick up, you know, and go on to Amazon.com and pick up Propaganda. There's a book just simply called Propaganda. It was published by Bernays in 1928. And it's really, 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 really important. And so, we just simply need to learn how to deconstruct these dominant narratives that are consistently bombarded into our cipher and into our mind space on a regular basis. So, you know, with the conversation of injustice, I want to this is actually something that you know, I wanted to play last week, but we didn't get a chance. We had such a charged show that I didn't get a chance to play this clip. But I want to play this clip, and I want to get, you know, your thoughts on it, Peter, on the other side, and also whoever's listening. I mean, I see people are listening live right now. I can see you on the virtual world known as internet. So if you want to call in, once again, the number is 347-945-5191. That's 347-945-5191. Peter and I, we don't screen calls, and unlike the corporate media, we actually aim to keep our audience as engaged as possible. So this show is as much yours as it is Peter's and mine. So without further ado, I want to play this clip, and we'll dissect it on the other end.
The New York City Police Force systematically withholds protective services from minority victims of crime, while simultaneously stopping and frisking hundreds of thousands of innocent black and brown citizens on the streets for no legitimate reason. Hundreds of hours of secret recordings by a disgruntled New York cop prove beyond question that the most aggressive forms of institutional racism are the guiding management principles of the NYPD. Just as the Black Panther Party and others charged 2 generations ago, the New York City police are revealed as an occupying army that views residents of color as an enemy population. The predatory nature of New York City policing is captured digitally in a police lieutenant's exhortation to his officers at the beginning of their shift. "You're working in Bed-Stuy," says the shift supervisor, "where everyone's probably got a warrant." The recordings were made during a continuous 16-month period in 2008 and 2009 and are the basis of a series of articles now running in the Village Voice newspaper. They show how the relentless pressures exerted by billionaire Mayor Michael Bloomberg and his top police brass result in a total perversion of the criminal justice system in places like Brooklyn's Bedford-Stuyvesant section, where the cop with the pocket digital recorder was assigned. The turncoat cop's recordings show that the police operate under a quota system, driven by their superiors to hand out vast quantities of summonses for petty offenses and to stop and frisk huge numbers of people. It is this quota system at the core of official police policy that has resulted in 2 million innocent people being stopped and frisked on the streets of New York since 2004, close to 600,000 in 2009 alone. 85% of the victims of this police state practice were black or Latino. Only 9% were white, although New York City is about 38% white. From roll call to end of shift, the New York police sweep the streets of non-white neighborhoods, stopping and searching more than 1,500 mostly black and brown pedestrians every day, the vast majority of whom are found to be carrying nothing illegal. Contrary to the police lieutenant's admonition to his officers, not everyone in places like Bedford-Stuyvesant has an outstanding warrant, but the police routinely act as if they do. This has nothing to do with fighting crime. In fact, the secret recordings show that police systematically discourage residents from reporting actual crimes committed against them in order to keep the crime statistics artificially low and thus make the top brass and the mayor look good. Citizens that complain of being assaulted or robbed are often threatened with arrest themselves by belligerent detectives trying to fudge the figures. Felonies are routinely downgraded to misdemeanors, not because of clogged courts, but to give the appearance of a safer city. After police suppression of crime statistics was exposed in Bedford-Stuyvesant, preventing the cops from intimidating victims, felony assault statistics jumped 76%. The black and brown residents of New York City are stopped, harassed, and abused by the millions, while the real crimes committed against them are swept under the rug by an occupation army in blue, masquerading as law enforcement. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
Peter, thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, my first thought is, you know, just one of outrage and indignation to know that, you know, this kind of thing is going on a regular basis on the city streets of, you know, the country that claims to be the home of the free, right? You know, we talk about this being a free country and a land of liberty and all of that nonsense. And again, there's that narrative, you know, the dominant narrative is that this is a free country, et cetera, and so forth. And yet still the facts help belie the reality that there is a police state that exists in much of urban America. And, of course, urban America is the home to most of the black and brown skin residents of our country. And so they make for easy targets, you know. And I think the what's important in looking at this is to thinking critically about why this type of police state exists in this country, you know, and on the one hand, understand that, you know, Bloomberg's tough on crime philosophy is just a redressing of the law and order plank that started with, the regressives in the 1960s with the Goldwater conservatives, and then, you know, it was Nixon. President Nixon was, you know, he made the law and order agenda very popular and cracked down on crime. And if we look starting in 1970 at the explosion of the number of black and brown inmates in our country's penal system, it's very instructive in terms of understanding what that agenda is really about. It's about a police state system in our urban centers. That intentionally and purposely, just like we're finding out from some of the reports from New York City, that this is intentional. You know, this isn't just by happenstance. When you have 9% of 2 million people that have been stopped and frisked on the streets of New York City, 9% are white. What does that tell you? And then to look at another telling statistic, at the over 2 million inmates in our country's prisons. That over a million of them are black, and, you know, just the grossly disproportionate number of black and brown skin inmates in the penal system points very clearly to the fact that racism is a driving factor in the stopping, the frisking, the arresting, the arraigning, the sentencing, that whole process. But deeper still, we need to look at the system that breeds this kind of police state, and look at the the systemic reasons for the kind of crimes that people are being arrested for. You know, and if we look at, you know, the social indicators in terms of a lack of employment, lack of access to the things that make for a decent life, health care and child care for kids and good schools, and you know, one statistic in particular that stands out is the number of high school dropouts that are amongst the over 2 million inmates in our prisons. We look at that, and we see there's a direct correlation between folks not finishing high school and ending up in jail or eventually prison. Another one is the number of mentally ill in our nation's jails and prisons. Why is it in the so-called richest nation on the planet, right? We talk on the one hand about how wealthy this country is and how the riches we have because of this great capitalist system brings us all this wealth and all these riches, right? But on the other hand, we can't seem to educate our kids and keep kids in school. We can't seem to provide mental health care for literally millions of people. And that started, we saw deinstitutionalization become a political policy under the Reagan administration when folks were turned out on the streets by the thousands and tens of thousands over the course of the years since the Reagan administration. And many of those folks, they end up in our jails and prisons. And so there's a very, very sick system at the center of all of these symptoms that we're looking at. You know, the kind of things that we're talking about are simply symptoms. It's the sickness is to be found in the system. And that's one of the biggest problems, is not to look at the individuals as having some kind of moral depravity, okay? But to look at the system. This is a system that breeds orphans and breeds widows and breeds homeless people and breeds mentally ill people and doesn't take care of its own. And so, there's a very serious ideological battle that's being waged. And unfortunately, the folks with the least of these, all right, the folks with the least means to fend for themselves are the ones who end up getting hurt the most. And we can look at that. You know, and okay, let's make some connections. You know, we started off at the top of the hour talking about, you know, some of the ecological disasters and some of the other disasters wrought by the rapaciousness of capitalism. And you mentioned some of the individuals and families in the Niger Delta. And you know, I would refer our listeners to just look up the Niger Delta and look up. Go and see how many families whose livelihoods have been devastated by, you know, gas companies and oil companies going into that region devastating the fishing industry in the Niger Delta region. Look at what's going on in the nation of India today, as corporations are with a seemingly bottomless appetite going after the natural resources that are underneath the ground, where, you know, millions, literally millions of people, of Indians live. And so those Indians are being criminalized. The government is going after those individuals and using all kinds of labels against them, calling them communists, calling them Maoists, calling them terrorists, insurgents, all kinds of things, just to justify pushing them off the lands on which they and their ancestors have lived for generations and centuries.
Right.
And so we see connections here. We can connect some dots here. So what's relevant in New York City, we can make a connection to what's going on in the Niger Delta, and we can make a connection to what's going on in other parts of the world. And so I think it's important to think critically about a system that breeds this kind of abuse of human life. But specifically what's going on the streets in New York City, I think is, you know, there's a particularly uniquely American character to that, and obviously we know that's racism, and how that's played out in the United States is unique, I think, in the world, and so we're seeing just the ugliness of it, and how racism is used as a political football by politicians like Bloomberg and who was the guy before in Solomon? Who was the mayor?
Oh, that's friggin'
evil. Giuliani.
Yeah, well, Don't say Giuliani without prefacing that evil scoundrel, friggin'
right.
you
right.
know, crypt looking. You know, he reminds you of, if you ever remember the show on HBO, the Tales from the Crypt. I mean, he's one of the most vile looking
right.
individuals.
Yeah, the Crypt Keeper. Rudy the Crypt Keeper Giuliani. You know, so we can see how we can see a system here. We can see a pattern here of how racism is used as a technique to enforce police state measures. Even in major urban centers across this country. So it's very troubling, obviously, to see what's going on in New York City, and from where I sit, Solomon, to see what's going on in the state of Arizona. You know, so we see that this isn't just an isolated incident. It's not something that's just unique to Phoenix or to Arizona. It's not something that's just unique to New York City. But this is a nationwide problem. This is a nationwide issue, the issue of racism and white supremacy in this country. And I will say it again that I saw this coming. With the election of Barack Obama as president, I saw it coming. I saw the retrenching of regressive racist forces, and we're seeing how that's playing out now. We're seeing it playing out, and unfortunately, we haven't seen the worst of it. I think it's going to get worse before it gets better, because it's going to continue to get worse until progressives step up and say enough is enough. So, those are the lessons we have to take from it. It's one thing to hear these statistics and understand what's going on in Arizona and Texas and New York City with individuals and families like the woman who was going to be on our show today. And it's one thing to hear those things, and it's another thing to do something about them. So we need to use those incidents as our fuel for being about, first of all, critical thinking, and then critical action. So generating some kind of critical action from the information that we take in.
Yeah, and when you speak India, it's interesting that you bring up India, and people should know, that right now that it's kind of like sick that corporations would even be putting pressure on people to resist, because based on what happened in 1984.
Right.
People in India have every reason to fight tooth and nail against these multinational corporations that are doing tremendous environmental damage, which therefore has taken thousands upon thousands of lives. And you look at 1984 with the Bhopal gas tragedy that involved Union Carbide. Union Carbide is a U.S. based gas company, or energy company, and it resulted in close to 4,000 deaths by conservative estimates. Other estimates puts it up in there 15,000, but over 500,000 people were in essence affected by it, and to this day you have hundreds of thousands of people who are experiencing all kinds of health-related issues,
right.
because of that disaster, that tragedy, that injustice. You know, it was an injustice. You know, and so you had folks like Warren Anderson who was with who was with the Union Carbide Corporation, who fled the country and now resides in the U.S. and the U.S. refuses to extradite him to face justice in India. And so, the U.S. definitely harbors like known environmental terrorists as well as known terrorists. When we look at even folks like Louis Posada, who was the counter-revolutionary Cuban terrorist who resides now in the U.S. and was responsible for terrorist acts in Cuba and also in Venezuela when he was involved in the bombing of that Pan Am flight and he's in Venezuela has been asking to extradite him, but the U.S. harbors him, and so it's just interesting at the same time the U.S. is preventing the Cuban Five from having any kind of semblance of of justice. And so,
right.
Looking at keeping it on environmental injustice and environmental racism, which is rooted in the institutional racism that this country, you know, produces. Man, I mean this you know, this country, you know, they produce a lot of soybean, but before that they produce a lot of white supremacy and racism, and ooh, they do it so good. So since we're talking about Bhopal and India, I want to play this clip in relation to the black people in this country, American-born Africans, and nuclear energy.
The nuclear power industry will soon launch a major propaganda campaign in black America, hyping atomic energy as a jobs program. I've seen it all before, up close, more than 30 years ago, when the Westinghouse Corporation became a regular advertiser on the syndicated television news program I co-owned and hosted, America's Black Forum. That was back in 1978, a year before the near meltdown at Three Mile Island. The Pittsburgh-based Nuclear Power Corporation had just completed a study that showed African Americans were more interested in jobs and less concerned about environmental issues than whites. Westinghouse's executives figured that jobs-hungry black folks would serve as a counterpoint to the long-haired white kids and tree-huggers that the media caricatured as the core of the environmental movement. We should note that the data in Westinghouse's survey did not say that blacks were friendlier to nuclear power than whites, only that they cared more about jobs as a logical consequence of having fewer of them. The idea was to convince blacks that nukes equals jobs, and that words like environment and ecology had nothing to do with them. So, with great hopes of political success, Westinghouse bought advertising, lots of it, on my show and other black-oriented media around the country. 1978 was also the year that the modern environmental justice movement began, under the godfathership of Dr. Robert Bullard, a black environmental sociologist who was documenting how America dumps its industrial and other unwanted wastes disproportionately in black neighborhoods. Dr. Bullard's data provided the objective evidence that proved the crucial link between environmental issues and social justice. As far as Dr. Bullard is concerned, the racial politics of nuclear power is no different than the politics of other industrial hazards. It's easier to dump them in black neighborhoods. And now, as 30 years ago, black unemployment remains roughly twice the rate of whites, leading nuclear power corporations to believe that blacks will be far more enthusiastic than whites about any industrial scheme that holds out the hope of jobs. With President Obama's blessing and more than $8 billion in guaranteed public money, the nuclear power folks plan to build two new plants in majority black and desperately poor Burke County, Georgia, where cancer rates are far higher than surrounding regions and jobs are still scarce for blacks, even though nuclear plants have been located there since the 1950s. In an article in the Huffington Post, Dr. Robert Bullard told Black Agenda Report's Bruce Dixon that black communities on the fence lines of nuclear plants don't get the jobs. They get pollution and more poverty, and they get sick. But corporate promoters are already re-revving their propaganda machines to sell blacks on nuclear power with the same jobs creation argument they pushed three decades ago. Nuclear companies have been flying black and brown delegations to visit happy neighborhoods around power plants in France. The black press is on board too, because that's where the advertising dollars are, and because the black president says that nukes mean jobs. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
So, Peter, that's exactly what we were talking about. That's exactly what we were talking about in it. And, you know, and that's been going on for a very, very long time. And, you know, black and brown communities have for a long time been havens for the dumping ground of toxic waste that has eventually found its way into drinking water, and those types of things. Right here in D.C., you know, we have an issue going on right now. It was a report that came out in the Washington Post that showed that that there was a masking up of how bad the water is at D.C. It had, you know, large levels of high levels of toxins in the water, and Lord knows how long, you know, children and their families have been drinking that water. So you know, this is nothing new, but unfortunately, you know, far too many folks in America, the reality of it is very new to them, even though it's been something that's been going on for a long time, but that corporate media, you know, doesn't have a good record of putting this kind of news out there in its proper context or out there in general.
Well, let's go back to the concept that you raised, or the particular term that you brought up a few minutes ago, namely propaganda. I can remember when I was in school, you know, taking civics class and the social studies and learning about propaganda. And the only place that propaganda ever took place in history, at least according to the history books of the public schools that I went to, was in places like Nazi Germany or in Stalinist Soviet Union. It was always propaganda. We know that, you know, there was in fact propaganda ministries or branches of the government that were primarily engaged in propaganda in some of those countries, as well as other countries. But my point is that that was put out there in contraposition to the honesty and transparency of the United States government and of media in America, that the media in America and much more so the government of the United States only puts out the unvarnished facts of what's going on and only reports in truthful manner of what's happening. And so, you know, propaganda was something that took place in these evil totalitarian societies, you know, and free speech was something that takes place in the United States. Well, you know, obviously that is a gross, gross, gross distortion of reality, and propaganda takes place in this country much more than folks will ever realize. And this is one of the areas where propaganda is literally lethal. Because so many Americans have never heard of a lot of these eco-terrorism really is what it is, in terms of you know, terrorizing communities, giving them, you know, the choice between a job working in a hazardous environment or no jobs at all. Well, obviously, in that kind of a context, people are going to, you know, they're going to take whatever work they can. I mean, you look at communities across the racial and ethnic spectrum, and you see people of low income, working class, impoverished people of all ethnic backgrounds taking the kinds of jobs, whatever jobs they can come by, irregardless of how dangerous or hazardous they may be to their health. We can see that across time in this country, whether it's the coal mines, the lane of the railroads, Native Americans working in uranium and plutonium mines out in this part of the country, and all the damage that takes place. You know, and I had the opportunity to spend some time in New Orleans back in the 90s, and at that particular time when I was there, New Orleans was the murder capital of the United States. And the part of town that had the most murders per capita was the section of town called the Desire Street Housing Project. And the Desire Street Housing Projects was one of the most dastardly designed housing projects in the country. And you know, I've seen a number of housing projects over the course of my lifetime in Cleveland and in Chicago and Dayton and some other cities. But the Desire Street projects, the thing that stood out in terms of the way that was designed was that a large portion of the Desire Street housing project was built on top of a toxic waste site. the local governments basically gave the state and the local parishes there permission to build on those sites. Why? Because they knew there was going to be poor black folks that were going to be living there, and the lives of poor people in this country are expendable, and the lives of poor people of color are that much more expendable. They're basically of little or no value. And so the Desire Street project was built on top of a toxic waste site, and several generations of children started to be born with all kinds of deformities and birth defects and so on and so forth. And, you know, of course, this is the kind of thing that doesn't make the news. And I think, you know, misinformation is one thing that we can recognize easily as propaganda, but the omission of information can be used just as propagandistic. And so it's the lack of this kind of information. I mean, think about the Tuskegee experiments. There are people in this country that I know of who have, you know, people who have high school diplomas and even some college educated folks who still don't believe that the Tuskegee experiments ever took place, because they just refuse to believe that a benevolent nation like the United States, which is a dirty joke to even utter those words, but would never perpetrate, you know, that kind of a thing on its own citizens. But the facts are there. You know, the Tuskegee experiments was very real. What happened with the Desire Street housing projects is very real. What's happening now is a recycling of the kind of ecological racism that has been part and parcel of this country as long as we can care to look back into history. And the other side of that tragedy, Solomon, is that the United States, because again of the drive for profit in the capitalist system, the United States government essentially refuses to make a serious effort into investing into and developing alternative forms of energy. Why are we even having a conversation about nuclear energy when we know that there are cleaner and safer alternatives in terms of wind power, solar power, thermal power, hydropower, all kinds of alternatives that not only are cleaner and safer, but would create thousands and thousands of jobs in perpetuity. You know, so this is the kind of damage that capitalism is doing, not only in perpetuating unsafe and unclean forms of fuel and energy. Again, looking at what's happening in the Gulf of Mexico, why the need to drill for more oil and find more oil? We should be weaning ourselves off of the use of oil and other carbon-based fuel products. When I couldn't help but laugh out loud whenever I hear then candidate and now President Obama talk about investing in clean coal. I mean, that's utterly ridiculous. It's one of the most oxymoronic phrases I've ever heard. It's like saying, you know, it's like saying dry water. You know, it just doesn't exist. You know, to talk about clean coal just doesn't exist. It's a dirty joke to impose on the American people in terms of investing further in the use of coal for energy, while we don't invest in the kinds of clean and safe products for fuel and for energy, like wind and power and so forth. I tell you what, in this part of the country, Solomon, I can't think of any reason why every home and every business out in the state of Arizona here isn't covered with solar panels to generate its own power. Yet that's not the case. Why? Because the companies that do generate electricity out here are making way too much money in the traditional ways. And so, you know, there isn't a big movement to have solar power to provide energy for homes and businesses out here. You know, what is the other explanation? There isn't one. And so we're seeing the same thing when it comes to this regurgitated argument about nuclear power. We know it's not the safest. We know it's not the cleanest. And we know that it's not necessary. We don't need to put people's lives in danger when there are other more viable sources of energy. And it is unfortunate, yeah, and that's where the eco-racism comes in. The communities of color will be the ones to suffer the most as this goes forward.
Yeah, and biological, warfare, biological terrorism, was used hundreds of years ago. I mean, hundreds of years ago in this country. We don't even have to look at, within the last 100 years. Certainly it happened with Tuskegee, which was one of the most vile, despicable, racist things that has been done. But you can even look further than that this country that white immigrants, which is nothing short of, which brings us back to this whole stupid debate about immigration and these nitwits running around here and the Tea Party saying that they're trying to take back their country. This never was your country. Your ancestors, as some of you say, stole it fair and square, right? But anyways, those vile ancestors of theirs, you look what they did with smallpox, led by the likes of Lord Jeffrey Amherst, and you want to talk about critical thought and programming, you have University of Massachusetts at Amherst, named after Lord Jeffrey Amherst. I mean, you have in that town itself, you have restaurants, called the Lord Jeff, and the Lord Jeffrey, and named after Lord Jeffrey Amherst. And this is one of the more vile human beings, in history. I mean, they gave out blankets to the indigenous population, and marked it basically, as if they were doing some nice, they were doing something nice, for the indigenous folks, and had the audacity to do it under the guise of fellowship and brotherhood, knowing that they were infested with smallpox and that these people there was no immunity in any shape, form, or fashion, and smallpox killed off scores of indigenous folks, We know that. We know that to be the truth now, but that is not the truth that is commonly spoken. So it goes on, and best believe when we start to really break down and when the years, proceed, and we really start to look at some of these other diseases that are running rampant throughout this world right now. It shouldn't be a surprise to anybody that some of these diseases and some of these viruses, such as H1N1, such as even looking at HIV/AIDS, it shouldn't be a surprise to anybody if the strong data comes up and points that these things were man-made and.
Right.
Went awry or were blatantly planted. And, a great book for people to pick up, and man, one of the great books I've read in the past couple of years is, Medical Apartheid, by Sister Wright. That's definitely a book that folks should really, really pick up. So I want to go to this next clip. It's a bit of comic relief, but it's not. It's only a bit of comic relief because the character that the next clip is about to undress is somebody who because it goes into what we've been talking about this show. He's somebody who, because he says the right things and because he is a tool. For white America, he continually gets promoted and pushed up, and that's the big bright thing that we all should understand that in America, if you are a person of color, especially if you are a black man, if you don't say certain things, and you do say other things that quite frankly are middle of the road, very euphemistic, very much in support of this white supremacist system. Your scholarship is based around that. Your scholarship is really when compared to the likes of scholars who those of us are in the African community, you know, that really have taken a strong serious look at African history and its preservation. You know, looking at the likes of John Henry Clark, Dr. Ben Jacquinin, Ivan Van Sertima. You know, those, we can go on and on. Those folks, the reason they're not necessarily household names, and that, you know, compared to the household name of a Louis Gates, Skip Gates, are because their research and their countless years and years of research is not only is it African centered, but it's sound, it's solid, it's accurate, and it debunks all of the crap that has been put out there that kids from California to Massachusetts are taught every day around this Eurocentric perspective, that everything that is of substance in this world, especially in this country, comes from the white man, comes from the Eurocentric mold. And you know, so it's imperative, as Malcolm X said, only a damn fool would let their enemies teach their children. And I think it's really come to that point that, you know, we need to make as much of a concerted effort in the evenings and on the weekends to really to teach and counter what our children may or may not be getting in their so-called public school system. So I want to play this clip. Peter, I know you don't like this. We've talked about this clown, and I think you know the clown that Brother Glenn Ford, you know, undressed, and that is none other than Henry Louis Gates.
Like elders often say, we must trust people to be who they are. So when Henry Louis Gates describes his own career as that of an intellectual entrepreneur, we should believe him to be who he is, an intellect for hire, or more specifically, an academic hitman. John Perkins speaks of jackals and economic hitmen. Gates is higher education's equivalent. He is an academic William O'Neill or Cotton Smith, the intellectual version of those who set up radical leaders for assassination. Gates's targets are not individuals as much as they are entire intellectual communities, whose service to their people make his assaults on them assaults on the very people those intellectuals defend. His are politically motivated hits because of their broader ramifications, and like real hits, they permanently silence any meaningful debate. Gates's most recent hit appeared this week, as they often do, in the New York Times, which has been for decades an ideological killing field where anti-establishment intellectuals are routinely left for dead. In his piece, Ending the Slavery Blame Game, Gates returns to his favored, if not entirely discredited, theme of African culpability in the enslavement of their own. Gates blends his predilection for genetics with his undying need to blame Africans for their enslavement, and concludes that because statistical increases in the numbers of those sold into slavery coincides with the rise to prominence of particular African ethnic groups, that this is proof of a balance in benefits accrued by the process. His selective emphasis, or what Ali Mazrui has called ulterior selectivity, on one aspect of slavery versus another is designed to undermine a tradition of scholarship which has for decades shown how enslaving and colonizing Africans led to a decline of Africa and an ascendancy of the West. But as Walter Rodney said himself, the presence of a group of African sellouts is part of the definition of underdevelopment. And now they come again with what is their ulterior motive, the academic hit on Claudia Jones, Frantz Fanon, Walter Rodney, and many others. In fact, Gates has previously and personally taken John Henry Clark to his New York Times killing fields. Others, like Malcolm X, Chris Haney, and Rodney himself, were simply killed quite literally. Each was carried out for similar political purposes, to assure the African world's status as permanent servant. Assassins mute the kinds of debate which might result in their employer's loss of power. By simple omission, Gates kills the arguments of Nkobra, Ray Winbush, or F. Michael Higginbotham,
whose thoughts on reparations are far more compelling than can be allowed. The Three Scholars Gates does mention, in what is really no more than a simple blog post, will not have their views critiqued by their peers within the pages of the New York Times or mainstream media which considers the Times as the paper of record. So most will never know, for example, that Mazrui, a worldwide recognized authority on African history, dispatched of Gates and his incessant blame of Africans for slavery long ago. He said that African leaders were forced into the exchange and were themselves victims. But again, this view has been targeted for assassination and is preemptively and cyclically silenced so as to also silence, for example, calls for reparations or the cancellation of African debt. Though perhaps this time it was to also save Gates' protector-in-chief from himself. Remember, it was Obama who went to Ghana and blamed African crises on African corruption. And it is he who should now have to account for the recent report of the $1 trillion in African wealth illegally expropriated to the West, and this just over the last 40 years. And, Mr. President, the report concludes that only 3% of that can be attributed to corruption. To this we can add an earlier claim from former Federal Reserve Board member Andrew Brimmer that through denial of access to capital, adequate public service, and government benefits, Black Americans have been robbed of $10 billion every year since the so-called end of slavery. And here we have two points whose own ulterior selectivity demonstrates the weakness of the argument cooked up by Gates and Obama, that African involvement in slavery and post-colonial corruption are to be blamed at all or equally to the crimes of Western Europe or the United States. These, like the other favorite of a mythical black buying power, are mere attempts at the perfect hit. The Western assassination of the black world all covered up and dismissed as a suicide. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Jared Ball. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
And as you know, that was a correction. That was Brother Jared Ball, you know, with that report, as just indicated. But, the Henry Louis Gates, Peter, and his ilk, they're all throughout there, immersed in, you know, ivory tower after ivory tower, from major public and private university to major public and private, you know, and private university, as well as even, you know, not so major public and private universities, and the way they get propped up, and folks, this is what Peter was talking about with he was talking about the his Institute for Critical Thought, is that you have to sometimes ask yourself the question, you know, why is it that you know the information that you know? Why do you find certain things popular? Why, you know, and when you ask yourself these questions, it should lead you to some solid investigation. And when you do that investigation, and you know, and you find out, damn, you know what I'm saying, I find this to be popular, or I know about this because now that for the first time I think about it, it's because I've been bombarded with this every single day, this kind of message and this kind of thought process and this kind of information or this kind of understanding of the world and my relationship in it. I've been getting this kind of stuff since I was in first grade from you know, all throughout my educational, like, vanguard, and wow. So yeah, I think it's very important. What do you think, Pete?
Yeah, it is important. It's important to understand these, and again, looking at this from a critical thinking perspective, because, you know, what we're going to see and we're going to hear more in the media about the you know, the prominence and the sterling intellect of individuals like Henry Louis Gates, because they are he in particular and others like him are phenotypically black. You know, they're black and brown skinned people who are parroting the white supremacy motif. They're basically spouting off ideas that support the white supremacy that undergirds American society. And you know, like Brother Ball said, you know, the presence of sellouts demonstrates the colonialism. And Franz Fanon, who he also mentioned, talked at length about the colonized mind and how part of colonialism, you know, is the way minds are colonized. So there's the physical colonization. There's also the intellectual colonization. And just real quickly, I just want to say that, you know, this is one of the group of black folks that Malcolm X railed against. He talked about them like you know, as the house Negroes, and I think he would include Skip Gates, Michael Steele, the author Shelby Steele, in that group today as the house Negroes that whose minds continue to be colonized. And whose minds need to undergo what Malcolm called a collective unbrainwashing.
Definitely. And this one, we want to thank you for joining us for another episode of Your World News. Like I said, you know, be on the lookout for that exclusive interview that we're going to have within the next 2 weeks or so. You know, that deals with the this story and this courageous struggle that this. Black woman is going through right now in her quest for justice and the end of police terrorism that she's experiencing in her own home, you know, within the community that she lives. And so we'll be having that show exclusively in a couple weeks, but you know, we'll be back on air next week, and so please continue to check the website for the posting of the next show, and please send this link to all of your friends and networks, all right? Just as you pass on, you know, sometimes meaningless, you know, chain emails, you know, pass this along. You know, this kind of information, whether it's this or some other news site or something like that, you know, we really have to really start to get the information out there and to break down the apathy. You know, in order to break down the apathy, we have to break down our understanding of knowledge and wisdom and those sorts of things, and how we've been mass programmed. We can break it up. You know, we just have to make the concerted effort, and we have to take the initiative to really to do it, to not just leave it with ourselves and our households. We have to push it on to our communities, and so. I think a very apropos song is going to take us out. This is Acrobatic and Chuck D and Kindred.
This is Chuck D. The effects of slavery have had a far-reaching effect on black people in America. The scars run deep, not just the physical, but the emotional and psychological scars as well. And they still hurt today. It's been said before that we can't know where we are going without knowing where we have been. Follow along as Acrobatic takes us on a journey back to how things started for us here and links the effects of that start to what we're still dealing with to this day.
It took me 6 years to build up enough courage to run and only 6 hours to be facing the barrel of a gun, not knowing if it's the last time I'd ever see my sons, and that's punishment enough, still the pain has just begun. A light flashes, leather from the whip lashes, he's threatening to burn me in my own ashes. Brown skin is now purple, it comes full circle, when the pain that I'll endure is the pain I'll have to work through. For now my body lies listless, wishing that my wife wasn't forced to witness, wishing she wasn't forced to be master's mistress, wishing she wasn't forced to be under this distress. How did we ever get into this mess? We came from kings, now we're wearing rags, eating unmentionable things. The stings from the welts in my back make me want to attack and be a martyr for blacks, but then the whip cracks and brings me back to reality. Madness, brutality that leads to fatalities. And if he knew that I was reading his books and getting smarter, it would only make him whip me harder. Sometimes I thank God I never had a daughter, but even if I did, in my death we'd connect through the pain, our souls kindred.
Katrina and her aftermath have long since been forgotten by many of those unaffected by her wrath felt in 2005. Once again, our people have been displaced by the thousands and were left to fend for themselves while those more fortunate were able to escape. Let's take a look at what may have been going on through the mind of victims of America's most infamous natural disaster.
I'm on my rooftop, sick and thirsty, asking God for mercy. Please spare my wife, she's only 30. School buses float atop murky waters. Could they have used them to at least evacuate our sons and daughters? We sleep because we have no choice. Dehydrated and we can't scream for help because we have no voice. Crying for what the helicopters never dropped us. The stench of bodies in piles is evident for miles. Caught with little hope, laid off with little income. Ghetto life is no joke, I'm broke and then some. My son is on his stomach, body riddled with heavy shakes. I guess we now know what happens when the levee breaks. For now my body lies listless, wishing that my wife wasn't forced to witness. Wishing she wasn't forced to be without me for Christmas. Wishing she wasn't forced to be under this distress. How did we ever get into this mess? We came from kings, now I feel I truly know why the caged bird sings. He sings to keep his mind off the pain of things, but the way that we were left to remain, it stings. Things like the welts on the back of my kin, now replaced by the toxic water attacking my skin. I bet the CNN is broadcasting the slaughter as gas prices rise like the water. I thank God I never had a daughter, but even if I did, in my death we connect through the pain, our souls kindred.